WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, known by its acronym DSOC, is a part of the Democratic Party, the left part of the Democratic Party, organized in 1973 by activists of different generations with roots in the CIO, the anti-McCarthy movement, civil rights, the anti-war movement, and feminism. DSOC's members now include Congressman Ron Dellums, William Wimpasinger, the president of the International Association of Machinists, Gloria Steinem of Ms. Magazine, and writer Nat Hentoff. Their agenda includes national health insurance, a full employment program, more worker control in the workplace, and stricter controls on corporations. The chair of DSOC, Michael Harrington, is with me now. He's been an activist for his adult life. He fought McCarthyism, joined the struggle for civil rights, and through his now famous book, The Other America, helped persuade Kennedy and Johnson to create special programs to deal with poverty. He was an outspoken critic of America's involvement in Vietnam, which helped to place him on the White House enemies list. In 1969, he headed the American delegation to the Socialist International Congress and was a delegate in 75 and 78. His most recent book is called Decade of Decision, and that's published in paper by Simon & Schuster. His forthcoming book is called The Next America. Michael Harrington, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
We'll be talking about a number of things during the next hour, but let's start by having an overview of DSOC, where it fits into the Democratic Party and what its agenda is.
Well, what it is really the first attempt to organize in the Democratic Party a socialist presence within the party's existing liberal labor wing. At the 1980 nominating convention in New York, we had for the first time in the history of the Democratic Party a meeting of the Socialist Caucus of the Democratic Party, attended by 50 delegates and alternates from 19 states. We work in the Democratic Party openly identifying ourselves as socialists, but we work with many non-socialists. Alas, in America, there are many more people who are not socialists than who are. On areas where we agree, full employment, against racism, against sexism, against militarist policies, etc. Our basic theory is that there are two ways for the radical movement in America to proceed. One way is you start your own party, you write a terrific program, and you invite everybody to leave the old parties and join you. I tried that for about 10 years. I was the chairman of the Socialist Party of the United States for 4 years. It didn't work. The other way is you work within an existing party seeking to transform it. That's what we're doing. We like to say that we are not in favor of a third party. We're in favor of a first party. That is to say, we want to create a new majority party. And we think that the Democratic Party is a mess, a swamp, a contradiction, which contains some of the worst people in the United States and almost all of the politically organized best people in the United States. It is our Archimedean point where we stand not to accept the present Democratic Party, but to use that party as a lever to transform it.
I'm almost surprised that the word socialist is in your title, since some people get very scared and alienated by that word.
Well, we think that in this country, the anti-socialism that is pervasive in this country is not designed, unfortunately, to repress a mass socialist movement, because there has not been such a movement in the United States for more than half a century. As long as this country is anti-socialist, it won't even be decently liberal. That is to say, America is to the right of every other advanced industrial democracy, precisely because it lacks a socialist movement and a conception of socialist alternatives. We feel that in carrying on the struggle in America to legitimate socialism, to make it part of the ordinary, commonplace dialogue, we are not simply doing something which is good for socialists, obviously that is, but we think we're doing something that's good for every American, because it will simply mean that we will finally grow up and become as mature an adult as the Europeans, the Canadians, the Japanese, all the other advanced industrial democracies.
What does socialism mean when you use the word?
Well, we call ourselves the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, and that's not an accident. I would say most Americans, when they think of socialism, think of a dictatorship, think of a totalitarian society. We identify with the democratic tradition of socialism, that is to say, with the Polish workers' movement rather than the Polish government. That is to say, with the Czechoslovakian communists following Dubček rather than with the Russian tanks, which in the name of, quote, socialism, put down a working-class, popular, and democratic movement. In the Western world, the movement we identify with, and it has many strains and tendencies in it, is the Democratic Socialist Movement. François Mitterrand, who today became president of France, Willy Brandt, the president of the Socialist International, in which we belong to, Olof Palme of Sweden, etc. So it is a profoundly democratic conception of socialism, a conception of socialism which does not propose to take away any liberty now guaranteed under the Bill of Rights, but rather to deepen liberties, which argues that the rights, the freedoms of speech, assembly, press, organization, religion, which are in our Bill of Rights, are undercut by the inequality of our economic and social system. That is to say, I am somewhat less equal than a corporation. I am somewhat less equal than a very rich person. I am less equal than the Conservative Political Action Committee because they can put hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars into defeating a George McGovern, into defeating a Liz Holtzman, whereas my resources are so much less. What we want to do is to deepen political democracy, not take it away, but make it much more meaningful by bringing democratic principles into the economy, into the distribution of income and wealth, into the society. So that's what we conceive of as socialism, as democratic socialism.
So many Democrats lost in the last election, and the Republicans swept in most states. And the response of of many Democrats right now is to try to become a more center-oriented group. Where do you think the power is going to be for the rebuilding of the Democratic Party, to move to the left or to move to the center?
Well, I certainly think, alas, that right now the main tendency within the Democratic Party, responding to the disaster of last November, is represented by people like Paul Tsongas in Massachusetts, Gary Hart in Colorado, John Glenn in Ohio, which says we must move to the right of Kennedy but stay a little bit to the left of Reagan. I think these people fail to realize that that political position was occupied by a man by the name of Jimmy Carter, and it didn't do too well for him. Secondly, I think that the American people elected Reagan because traditional liberalism of the Democratic Party, the liberalism from Roosevelt to Carter, granting that Carter was a particularly inept and unconvinced practitioner of that liberalism, but nevertheless, he was in his own inept way working out on a policy tradition, which has been the central Democratic policy tradition. It doesn't work. And I think the American people did not so much elect Ronald Reagan with a mandate for his program as they rejected Jimmy Carter. As a matter of fact, when the Reagan people talk about their huge mandate, they forget that of the eligible electorate, Carter got a higher percentage in 76 than Reagan got in 80, that Reagan got about 53% to 52% of the American electorate, which is not that much. Therefore, I think that what is needed, and by the way, one of the reasons that Reagan appeals to people, I think, to the degree that he does, he's one of the first politicians in this country in a long time to take a program seriously. He's really fighting for his program. I think of Jimmy Carter had fought for the Democratic domestic platform of 1976, once elected president, as vigorously as Ronald Reagan is fighting for the Republican platform, Carter might still be president. That's not my idea of salvation, but it's better than Reagan. But basically what we think, is that the fantasy liberalism or the fantasy conservatism that has now taken the place of the exhausted liberalism won't work. Reagan is going to punish real people, but it will not solve the crisis of inflation and simultaneous high unemployment. And therefore, the Democratic Party has to be ready with new ideas. When Reagan fails, Reagan will fail. When he fails, that does not automatically mean that the Democrats win. It means that the Democrats will only win or will only deserve to win if they have alternative policies to both Reagan and Carter. Therefore, I'm appalled right now that the Democratic National Chair, Mr. Manatt from California, the new chair, is trying to cut down the issues convention mandated at the 1980 Democratic Convention for 1982 and trying to turn it into an affair of essentially people appointed by party leaders and bureaucrats. I think what the Democratic Party needs right now is an infusion of grassroots participation, new ideas. I think, for example, that one has to place on the agenda the democratization of investment decisions in the United States. That one has to realize that the New Deal is played out, that if America is not suddenly going to leap to socialism, and I don't think it is, neither is it going to be able to stay with the old liberalism because that is totally tapped out. What is needed, I think, what is possible, is a much more radical liberalism, which will move in a socialist direction without yet being socialist, and which will be distinguished above all by placing democratic controls on basic investment decisions like what is being produced, where it is being produced, who is producing it, what price to charge, and so forth and so on.
Well, an excellent example of a New Deal program is the Social Security system, which is falling apart now and which is threatened to be curtailed in the immediate future by having benefits cut down for people of 62. And I know that that's currently being fought, but it's still a threat. Now, say the Social Security system falls to pieces. What kind of replacement for that and for other New Deal-style programs could you see that would be an example of what you're talking about, a more liberal approach?
Yeah, two responses. Number one, the reason Social Security is in trouble is not because of the system itself, but because when you have 7% plus, between 7 and 8% unemployment and inflation at the same time, you do two things. The unemployment cuts down the revenues to the Social Security system. The inflation increases the cost of a Social Security pension, which is indexed as it currently now is. Therefore, as I argued in Decade of Decision, I do not believe that you can solve the crisis of the Social Security system without solving the crisis of stagflation. I think the answer to the Social Security crisis is not to lower the real living standards of the poor in the United States. It is to get full employment with price stability, which I think is a very radical proposition that nobody is talking about. Secondly, our Social Security system is surrounded by all kinds of myths. And one of the myths is that it is an insurance system. And one of the reasons why Social Security, up until only yesterday, was the most popular tax in the United States. Up until yesterday, nobody ever complained about the Social Security tax for a very simple reason. They felt that's one of the taxes where you pay, but you get something from it. And it's like paying your insurance premiums. Never was. Our Social Security system is not funded. That is to say, when I pay into Social Security right now, when you pay into Social Security right now, that money is taken and immediately paid out in benefits to retired people. Then, when I retire, some other working person is going to pay for me. And it's not an insurance system. I would like to scrap the whole notion that it's an insurance system. I would like, for example, to pay for Social Security not out of one of the most regressive and unfair taxes in the United States, which is the Social Security tax, very regressive, very positive for rich people, very bad for working people in particular. Rather than doing that, I would like to change the system so it's paid for out of general revenues. The one thing you cannot do, short of catastrophically reducing the living standard of vulnerable people over 65 years of age, the one thing you cannot do is solve the Social Security crisis without dealing with full employment and inflation, since I'm convinced that Reagan is not going to solve those problems, since I'm convinced that Paul Tsongas and Gary Hart and John Glenn are not going to solve those problems, I think the Social Security crisis is going to be with us for a long time until that more radical liberalism that I'm talking about becomes a major political force in the liberal labor wing of the Democratic Party and this country moves to the left.
I want to reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm talking with Michael Harrington, and he's the national chair of DSOC, which is the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. They're holding their national conference now in Philadelphia, and it's at the University City Holiday Inn. And I neglected when I introduced him a few minutes ago to mention that there are some sessions that are open to the public. So let me briefly run through this before we continue our discussion. There's a session tomorrow night that Michael Harrington will be speaking at, along with Harry Britt, who's a gay activist and on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. John Conyers, a member of the Black Congressional Caucus, will be there, as well as a number of other people. That's tomorrow night at 8. Saturday at 1 o'clock, Harvey Cox will be speaking on the moral dimensions of socialism. And there will also be sessions on Sunday, and William Wimpasinger will be speaking Monday at noon. So this is at the University City Holiday Inn if you're interested in attending any of these sessions. Because Reagan was elected and because so many Republicans were elected during the past election, we have evidence, most of us think, that the country has become more conservative, a move to the right. But you say that this country is moving to the right, and it's moving to the center, and it's moving to the left at the same time. Would you explain that?
Yeah, I think it's not just now. I think it's really been true for a long time, for years and years. Let me go back to explain it, to a book that came out in 67 called The Political Beliefs of Americans by two political scientists, Hadley Cantrell and Lloyd Free. They did a survey of a scientific sample in 1964. That's the year in which Lyndon Johnson demolished Barry Goldwater. That's the year of the Great Society. That's the year of Medicare, federal aid to education, the war against poverty, all that. At that time, a majority of Americans, when asked, defined themselves as conservatives, ideologically. At the same time Free and Cantrell discovered, those same Americans, if you ask them operational questions, are you in favor of Medicare? Are you in favor of federal aid to education? Are you in favor of the war on poverty? They turned out to be liberals. I think the evidence is that that is still the case. There was a New York Times CBS poll about 2 weeks ago, which told about how more people are joining the Republican Party. And at the same time, those people, some of whom are joining the Republican Party, are in favor of national health. 70% turned out to be in favor of the right of a woman to have an abortion in, on the basis of her own decision and consultation with her doctor. What I'm saying is that the American people, I think, turned to Reagan because they felt that Carter was inadequate, a view which I shared, not what they did about it, but the view that Carter was inadequate, of course. They turned to Reagan not because of Reaganomics, certainly not because of Reagan's views on the rights of women, and the minorities and the like. But they turned to Reagan because he was the only alternative to Carter in a realistic sense. Therefore, I think that there is a basis in this country for the left to mobilize. I don't think that, we have been defeated in our terms of our program. I think there's still majorities for most of our programs. One final point. The U.S. Senate yesterday voted 96-0 to say they will not accept Reagan's Social Security cuts. That was a Republican motion. The Republican motion was rushed onto the floor of the Senate because they were terrified that the Democrats were going to come up with an even sharper motion in criticism of the president. I think that there is a huge majority of American people who are for Social Security. And when Stockman, Reagan, and company start coming and cutting that, they get pushed down. I think, thank God, that they have not been defeated but at least slowed down on their madness with regard to El Salvador. You now have both House and Senate committees. In the case of the Senate, the Senate committee voting 12-1, a committee with a Republican majority on it, Senate Foreign Relations, voting 12-1 to require Reagan to certify before giving any aid to El Salvador that the junta is in control of the military. And if he can certify that, he can certify that the moon is made of green cheese. What I'm saying then is I think, yes, America is moving to the right in one sense. Philosophically, most Americans are sick of the government, and in part for very good reasons. But at the same time, those same Americans who are sick of the government want the government to give them national health, want the government to spend more money on the environment, want the government to deal with full employment. And therefore, I think that there is a basis, a mass basis, for an alternate politics. There is not a mass basis for a tired, exhausted liberalism that can't cope with stagflation.
Well, traditionally, the group that socialists organize are the workers, and because of the changes in society and in where the jobs are, and the changing from like an industrial to a more service-oriented society, the nature of like what we'd call the working class seems to have changed a lot. Who do you see as like the people who you can speak to and who will understand what you're saying and organize around DSOC's agenda?
Well, number one, I still consider the working class, even though it indeed has changed in its composition, to be an absolutely crucial constituency. That change is a little tricky. It is true that, relatively speaking, there are fewer blue-collar workers today than 10 years ago, than 20, than 30 years ago. By the way, it is also true that, absolutely speaking, there are more blue-collar workers today than ever before in American history. There's been no absolute decline. It's a relative decline. Secondly, it is also true that the service sector has grown enormously. The service sector, it is well known, includes doctors, dentists, movie stars, professors, etc. It also includes automobile mechanics, dishwashers, maids at hotels and motels, and teenagers working at fast food operations. That is to say, the service sector is by no means synonymous with middle class, white collar, or non-working class. By my definition, I would define working class as meaning those people who are engaged in relatively low-paid, repetitive jobs where you're not allowed to think on the job, where there's very little decision-making on the job. I would say that a majority of people remain in the working class as I define it. Now, having said that, I absolutely agree that things have changed. It is almost impossible to organize people at McDonald's and Burger King because those teenagers turn over so fast. It's a temporary job. It's very hard to get a union there compared, let's say, to an automobile factory or a television factory. So sure, there are new problems. Also, the working class today contains many more women. And for a variety of reasons, historically, women have joined union less than men. It's obviously not has nothing to do with some genetic quality in being a woman. It has to do with the fact that women have simply not been in the workforce, not had the opportunity or the need to join unions. But by the way, there, I think one of the most exciting things now happening is the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, has now joined forces with working women and is trying to reach out. That, I think, is the strategy. Yes, the working force has changed. Yes, the working class is different. But that doesn't mean that one retreats from working class organizing. It means you go about it perhaps in different ways. The second constituency, which I think is somewhat new. So I'd say, number one, we look to those working people, and particularly the very exploited among them who are black, brown, female, and young, who have the very high unemployment rates, very low wages, last hired, first fired, and all the rest. Secondly, I think that there is a much enlarged constituency in the United States of college graduates and college students, that if you look at the occupational shifts, that in the post-war period, the number of professional, technical, and such jobs doubled as a percentage of the workforce. And you see the presence of this new group in things like the anti-war movement of the 60s, among the whites who supported the civil rights movement in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, in the feminist movement. That is to say, the appearance in politics of an educated stratum whose politics are not so much out of immediate, desperate, physical, material need, but whose politics often come out of a sense of injustice, a sense of alienation, a sense of the basic unfairness of the society. I think that we in DSOC see one of our tasks, and it's a very difficult task, of, as I once put it, these names are not totally familiar to everybody now, it's to unify the constituencies of the three Georges, George McGovern, George Meany, and George Wallace. By that I mean George McGovern was the candidate essentially of this college-educated generation. George Meany was the spokesperson for the more traditional blue-collar working class. George Wallace was the spokesperson for a portion of that working class whose genuine resentments at this society were wrongly focused on blacks, but whose resentments were good, true, and real, whose response to those resentments or what they made of those resentments was wrong. So we in DSOC, I think, by the way, one of the most extraordinary things about us is that we are not only a multi-generational organization, but we have, I would say, somewhere around a third of our members who are active trade unionists. We also have a very significant group of people with PhDs that we have tried in the college-educated movements, in the environmental movement, for example, to constantly pound away at the fact that it's not enough simply to be for a decent environment. You have to be worried about the workers who will lose their jobs if you shut down the nuclear industry. And you don't just say shut it down. You also say shut it down in a full employment program, creating alternate energy for America and creating jobs in the process. And similarly, we go into the trade union movement and say don't just hold on to any job, even if it's a carcinogenic job, even if it's a job that is destructive not only of the workers in the workplace but of the environment for everybody in the country. You don't have to do that. They're in a planned full employment program of the type that we advocate, there are alternate sources of employment doing environmentally good things. So in a sense, we try to unite these constituencies, and I will tell you it's sometimes difficult, but I think it has to be done.
Well, this kind of unity would hopefully prevent the alienation that was, I guess, in some ways a very generational kind of alienation a few years ago, where a lot of workers assumed that if you were like against the war, for instance, that you also hated them and they hated you, and that the two went hand in hand. This is a very new kind of coalition of academicians and young people and older people and workers.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, there's a perfect illustration of the problem. I spoke at the May 1979 demonstration in Washington right after Three Mile Island, the anti-nuclear demonstration. And I began by saying that the problem that we face is anti-nuclear activists is more radical than many people know. I say, for example, if we shut down the nuclear industry, we're going to destroy 150,000 jobs. There was a young man sitting out in the audience, and there were some friends of mine. When I said that, he just yelled out, "Tough." I then went on to say, there is a way, however, if we really committed this country to solar, et cetera, Senator Kennedy's subcommittee has indicated that we could create 200,000 jobs and have a net gain of 50,000 jobs while vastly improving the safety, energy, et cetera. At that point, the guy said, "Well, okay." Well, that sort of contemptuous attitude toward the problem of working people, I think, drove a lot of workers up the wall, and they were right to be driven up the wall. And on the other hand, I think that there are many people in the trade union movement who wrongly think that all of these movements are simply fronts for a bunch of middle-class dilettantes who are taking a tour of political activism before going and living off of daddy's money. And they don't realize, for example, that young college graduates, they are facing problems of unemployment. I teach at Queens College in the City University of New York. My students now are more and more dropping out of courses in philosophy, literature, et cetera, and getting into practical courses. That is to say, they're getting into accounting. They're going to law school, not because they want to be lawyers, but because a college degree doesn't mean that much anymore. And therefore, I say to trade unionists, look, these college students, many of them don't know it yet, but they've got some of the same problems that you've got. There is a basis you both gain from a full employment program, that the young people in America are being forced into jobs they don't like by the economy. Indeed, I would argue that the American economy has done more to design the curriculum of American higher education in the last 10 years than all the faculty committees put together and multiplied by 10. And so I think you can bring these together, but as I say, it's tough.
Do you think that unions are more receptive now to liberal thought? And do you think that the multinationals taking over as many industries as they've been, and I think, doing some union busting in a way, and in a lot of like franchise organizations preventing the starting up of unions, do you think that's changing the nature of unions also now?
Well, first of all, as to whether unions are more receptive to liberal or even left-wing or socialist thought, my answer is, and I tell my students at Queens College, this is my answer to everything, yes and no. That is to say, on the one hand, I think the best people in the labor movement have a real sense that this is a radical crisis, that they can't just go on the old way, that there have to be answers, new answers. I think that's why I was invited last year to speak at the United Automobile Workers Convention and the International Association of Machinists Convention. I gave at those conventions a socialist speech on coalition politics, talking as much as I'm talking to you now, and in both cases got a tremendous response from the delegates, in each case about 3,000 or 4,000 delegates. So in that sense, there's an openness. On the other hand, when your back is against the wall, when you're losing jobs like crazy, there then is a counter tendency, which is, I don't want two birds in the bush. I want the bird in the hand. And there is I think one of the tendencies of recessions and depressions is to conservatize trade unions, the working class in general. Everybody tries to figure out, how can I survive? I will forget about my brothers and my sisters. I will forget about third world workers. I will concentrate on me keeping my job. And this guy Harrington comes along with these terrific pie-in-the-sky proposals for 10 years from now. I can't eat those proposals. So I think you get both a radicalizing and a conservatizing of the trade union movement at the same time, which is where I think that it is so important that there be a clarity, because I think that workers who feel confused and conflicted, if they could hear the kind of program that I'm talking about, if that program could grow in the trade union movement, I think it could offset, it could so to speak, build on the radicalizing tendency and offset the conservativizing tendency. The other point you mentioned is extremely important, which is in general, even before the multinationals emerged as a major force after World War II, I would argue that in every trade union negotiation, there is an implicit management threat on the table. Sometimes it's explicit, but it's always there. And that threat is, if you folks really keep this up, we're going to move. We're going to go out of town. We don't have to stay here. And if we go 1,000 miles or if we go 3,000 miles, you can't follow us. And now with the multinationals, we know that outfits, anti-union outfits like Texas Instruments, have left the United States and gone to the Caribbean. When in the Caribbean, a concerted international trade union effort actually managed to organize, they just moved. We know that there were multinationals that, in this case, mainly sort of small cockroach capitalist operations rather than Texas Instrument types, who went to Puerto Rico and took advantage of the sub-minimum wage development there during Operation Bootstrap. And as soon as, so to speak, they had sucked everything out of Puerto Rico that they possibly could, they then moved on to some poorer country, to Haiti or what have you. So I think that that is a tremendous problem, and that I think one of the answers to it has got to be international trade union organization. The international secretariats, mainly located in Europe, I think have been taking on greater importance in recent years. For example, this coming week in Washington, there will be a meeting of the International Metal Workers Secretariat, which brings together metal workers from all over the world, including people from the machinists and the UAW. Many American unions are affiliated. And they will be talking about what can they do. In Europe, where it's, of course, a much smaller scale, but nevertheless it's international, it goes beyond national lines, you've had the development of a European trade union movement, bringing together all the unions in the common market. And in some cases, strike support on a common market-wide basis. So that when, for example, there was a strike several years ago at British Ford, and British Ford threatened to the Ford workers that they would take the production there and locate it at German Ford, the German Ford workers announced that they would not work overtime. They're not going to go on strike, but no overtime, which really undercut that attempt. One last point, which I find fascinating, in Germany, under a law that was introduced by the British government, then a Labor government, during the military occupation after World War II, you have something called co-determination, where you have workers elected to be representatives on the boards of directors of major corporations in Germany. The workers of one of the American-owned auto multinationals, I think it's GM, but I'm not sure, the German workers elected the secretary of the Metal Workers International Secretariat, who is an American citizen. So you have an American citizen representing German workers on a German board of directors. And their reasoning was that since this man, his name is Hermann Rebhan, had come out of the UAW, knew this company, had ties to the United States, that it was in the interest of the German workers to be represented not exclusively but among others by an American trade unionist because he would have some sense of the international implications of their problems. So I think that the internationalism of the working class, which has long been a dream, has now become something of a necessity.
I guess because the industries have become international, right, so the workers right. have to also. I'm talking to Michael Harrington, who is the national chairman of the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, which is having its national convention or conference, I should say, now in Philadelphia, and that's at the University City Holiday Inn, and there are some sessions that will be open to the public. What kind of full employment program would you endorse?
Well, let me put it obviously a little too simplistically, since a full answer would take a couple of weeks. But if I could put it in slogan fashion, which nevertheless I think gets to an idea, I think that what we need is to have a planned program for full employment, which will put workers to work fighting the structural sources of inflation. That is to say, I think part of the key of dealing with stagflation, which is this new phenomenon of simultaneous high unemployment and high inflation. In the old pre-1970 economy, in general, when unemployment went up, prices went down. When unemployment went down, prices went up. Therefore, you could sort of maneuver against unemployment by a little inflation. You could maneuver against inflation by a little unemployment. That was the conventional wisdom from Roosevelt to Carter. It broke down starting with Nixon, 69-70, when it suddenly turned out that you could increase unemployment and prices at the same time. Therefore, I think the radical new approach has to be a two-pronged approach. You can't simply fight unemployment. If the fight against unemployment is going to cause inflation, when you have a situation where, as now, where roughly 8% of the workforce is out of work, 92% are working, if you have a program to put the 8% back to work, which vastly increases the prices and decreases the real buying power of the 92%, you're not going to do it. That's the tragedy of Jimmy Carter in a nutshell, is that he tried the old wisdom at a time when it simply no longer worked. Therefore, what I would say for full employment is put people to work dealing with the sources of inflation. The sources of inflation are not welfare mothers. They are not people getting food stamps or Medicaid. The sources of inflation are things like a transportation system in the United States in which mass transit was destroyed, the railroads were destroyed, billions of government subsidies were showered on the private automobile and the truckers. One of the things that we should put people to work doing is creating a decent, efficient rail system in the Northeast and Midwest, which I believe would have to be under public ownership. The private railroads ruined the private railroads in this area. Similarly, I would argue that if we put people to work building a human-scaled solar technology, that would not only create unemployment, but it would make us less dependent on oil. It would be better for the environment. It would simultaneously create jobs and fight inflation. Finally, I think in terms of fighting inflation, that one of the central problems there is hardly ever addressed in American society. And that is that we increasingly live in a society of fixed prices. All the right wing is when you say that you want to have price controls, they go climbing up the wall. The idea that you would violate the law of supply and demand and have human beings come in and actually decide in their fallible, miserable way what's the proper price for a product, that's terrible, they say. The fact of the matter is we have price controls right now in all major industries. GM is a price-controlling industry. As a matter of fact, the automobile industry is a perfect example of what I mean. There are three automobile companies. One is almost bankrupt. One is still strong. Which is the one that is cutting prices the most? The near-bankrupt one. Which is the one that is cutting prices at least the strongest? That is to say, in American society, now, the way corporations actually set prices, economics one to the contrary notwithstanding, is by taking the cost of the materials and labor, the anticipated rate of inflation, a targeted rate of profit, and that, not the law of supply and demand, is the way prices are fixed in American society. The result is that whereas in the 30s, 40s, 50s, even the 60s, a recession would bring down prices because in a recession, as demand contracted, corporations would respond by lowering prices to maintain volume. Now you have a recession, and corporations raise prices to maintain profits at a lower volume. And so now, rather than a recession being an incitement, an inducement to lower prices, it becomes a stimulus to raise prices. What I'm saying is that in addition to all those other fine things, I think you need price controls. I do not say wage controls. Now, I'm aware that politically that's a very difficult position, to advocate price controls without wage controls. Maybe it's impossible. But the fact of the matter, I believe that for the last 15 years, the problem of inflation has not been caused by workers' wages. It's been caused by corporate price fixing. And if one were rational, which American society very rarely is, one would therefore have price controls and no wage controls at all.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in what you were saying is that you'd like to see government ownership of, for instance, the rail systems. And as you're talking about government ownership of some systems, what we're seeing in a way is a more corporate-style running of the government, which is exactly the opposite of what you're talking about. What do you see the input now of corporate people and corporations of being into the government?
Well, I think the railroads are a classic case. First of all, in the United States, there's only one kind of property the government ever takes over. That's something that will not work. Anything that the government owns in the United States, with an exception or two, is unworkable. Therefore, after Penn Central destroyed Penn Central, and according to the Securities and Exchange Commission, perhaps there were things that the public prosecutor should have looked at in that destruction. After Penn Central destroys Penn Central, the government takes it over. And now everybody says, my God, the government runs a terrible railroad. Look at Conrail, look at Amtrak, look at all the money they're costing. The fact of the matter is, when you nationalize a rundown, non-profitable business, it's very hard to make it profitable and well-run. Now Reagan is compounding that. Apparently, by some accident, when the government took over, in effect, the Penn Central and much of the rail system in the Northeast and Midwest, it accidentally got a couple of profitable pieces of property. Reagan has now proposed to take anything that is profitable in the system and to sell it to private enterprise, which is not private enterprise. It's in this case a subsidized welfare handout enterprise. And at the same time, for the government only to maintain the profitless portion of the system. And then what he wants to do is to cut back service as a way of dealing with the low profits, that is to say, simply to cut out any kind of rail service to all kinds of communities. I think what is needed there is a publicly owned rail system, perhaps in this case regional ownership would be better than national ownership, a TVA-type corporation for the Northeast, another TVA-type rail corporation for the Midwest, and to really have put people to work building a good rail system. I like to joke with audiences that my radical demand is that America have, in the year 2000, a rail system as good as the one that now exists in France and Italy. And it does not seem to me to be utopian to think that the United States can catch up with France and Italy, and French and Italian capitalism, after all. One last point on this, which I think is very important, particularly in view of what happened today, that is to say, a socialist was inaugurated as the president of France. That one of the stories that the American press has missed with regard to François Mitterrand and has missed with regard to European socialism in general is that by far and large it no longer has a centralized, bureaucratic, public ownership conception, but it is much more concerned about decentralized ownership. It is much more concerned about the actual involvement of the workers. And therefore, what Mitterrand is going to try to do is something infinitely more radical than nationalizing corporations. He's actually committed to trying to socialize them, to actually bring in workers in the public into the operation of the system. And so when I talk about the need for public ownership, I don't simply mean the passing a law which transfers titles from a private bureaucracy to a public bureaucracy. I mean trying to design laws which will actually involve workers in the public and making the economic decisions that affect their lives.
We vote for our elected leaders, and they, for instance, Reagan appoints a cabinet of people and has what's also called the kitchen cabinet, which is all, and we don't vote for those people, and we have really no influence or control. And those people have enormous influence on the people who we have elected. Now a lot of those people have come right from corporations, right, and maybe still have a foot in them, or in the case of some advisors are still right in the middle of them. So how much of our government policy do you think is being influenced now by corporate considerations?
Well, let me just make a preface, because I want to plug a brilliant idea of my wife's. She wrote an article about it, I think it was in the Village Voice, or I'm not sure exactly where it appeared, but in any case, she is outraged by the fact that now when you vote for somebody, you get, for the president of the United States, you get a first lady in thrown in, and hopefully some point we'll get a first husband. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine by the name of Derek Shearer is married to Ruth Goldway, who is the new mayor of Santa Monica, and Derek goes around calling himself the first husband of Santa Monica now. But this unofficial advising, I mean, nobody voted for Nancy Reagan, yet nobody voted for Rosalind Carter, yet all of a sudden you get this. And Stephanie's point in her article was, if a president wants his wife to be a public personality, let him appoint her to a position in the government subject to confirmation by the Senate, like any other policy position. And then she or he, in that happy day when we have a woman president, must be available to the press like any other official, that you do not have this coy relationship of being wife and power behind the throne. Secondly, I think that in American politics, it is very obvious when conservatives are in power now that you have a totally corporate-dominated government. I think the case that is more difficult to understand and more important to understand is when liberals are in power, you also get corporate-dominated government. And it's not because the liberals are selling out. Maybe some liberal or two or three or ten or what have you sells out. But I don't think that's the fundamental explanation. I think the fundamental explanation is American society is structured so that corporations are in control of the fundamental investment decisions of the society. No president can run this society against the will of the corporations of America. Every president has to adapt to corporate power. A Ronald Reagan does so joyously because he believes in it. A Jimmy Carter does so with somewhat less joy, although not too reluctantly, because every once in a while he remembers some populist phrase from his youth. A Lyndon Johnson, a little more populist, a little less enthusiastic. But all presidents in this country, left, right, or center, adapt and pander to corporations. Therefore, I think that and this gets back to what are the alternatives to Reaganism. It's not enough simply to throw Reagan out. One has to change the fundamental structures which make liberal governments subservient to corporate decision. I admire François Mitterrand tremendously. I know him somewhat. I have discussed this with him. He is perfectly aware of the problem. He now is going to have to find some way to make a deal with the French bourgeoisie. He cannot do anything he wants. And he's aware of that. He's in a much better situation than a liberal politician in America because, A, he is aware of it, B, he has said so publicly, C, there are political movements which understand the nature of corporate and capitalist power in France. But still, this is a problem that afflicts my socialist friends in Europe as well as my liberal friends in America. And that's why in the reforms that one makes to deal with the problem of stagflation, to create the alternative to Reagan, I think it's important to have reforms which begin to change the structure and to actually take some of that corporate power over the left away. That the corporations have power over the right is clear enough, but they also have power over us.
How can you do that?
Oh, I think, number one, the radical redistribution of income and wealth in the United States. I would have confiscatory taxes on large inheritances. As a matter of fact, there's an idea that one of Mitterrand's chief economic advisors have that I think we might think of. His name is Jacques Attali. Attali's idea is that one generation can leave stock to another generation, but not voting rights in stock. That they can leave the value of the stock, but that the voting rights are taken away. The voting rights, if they want to pass it on to the next generation, the voting rights will be exercised either by the workers in that corporation, by the government, by the people. Somebody else will take over the voting rights. I think that kind of structural reform actually changing the distribution of income and wealth. Secondly, I think that Doug Fraser going on the board of Chrysler is fine. I'm for it. But the problem is a Doug Fraser gets on the board of Chrysler because Chrysler is broken down, needs Doug Fraser's help in getting a bailout passed, and it puts Doug Fraser on at the precise moment when his leverage is the least. What I am interested in seeing is not I am for workers' representation on the boards of directors of failing companies, but I am also very much interested in workers' representation on the boards of directors of successful companies, GM. I remember at the right at the time that the UAW signed with Chrysler, I happened to be giving a speech in Detroit, and some ultra-left radical said, oh, you don't go far enough. What we should have is the workers should take over Chrysler. And I said to him, good Lord, why do you want the workers to take over such a broken down, profitless, no good piece of property? I want the workers to take over GM, not Chrysler. But I think actually bringing worker and public representatives on the board of directors. Let me take an example, which is actually a bill in the U.S. Congress. It's the Ford Regal bill, Congressman Ford from Michigan, Senator Regal from Michigan. And it's a bill that provides that major corporations which want to leave an area, like when Ford closed down its plant in Mahwah, New Jersey, must give advance public notice 2 to 3 years in advance, must publicly defend their move in terms not simply of the private benefits but the social costs and benefits, must work with the local authorities to deal with the disruptions that they are going to create and to deal with the workers who are going to be displaced. And if it turns out that the social costs are so huge and the private benefits relative to the social costs so small that that corporation be deprived of all tax rights in making its move, that it get no investment tax credit, that it not even be allowed to deduct its move as a business expense. What I'm saying, and I perhaps indiscreetly will take a phrase from the Communist Manifesto. In the Communist Manifesto, where Marx and Engels were outlining the transitional program, the immediate program, a 10-point program, they talked on about making despotic inroads on the power of capital. It was not a program to socialize the economy. It was a transitional program and despotic inroads. And what I think that we have to do is to take many management functions, many functions of capital that up until now have been regarded as private and sacrosanct, and say, these functions, like what price shall we charge for an automobile? Shall we build the automobile in Hamtramck, Michigan, Mahwah, New Jersey? Shall we build the computers in the United States, or should we escape the Union and go to the Caribbean? These decisions are no longer private decisions, that the public has to deal itself into those decisions. And if I think it's stupid to talk about overnight socialization of the entire American economy, it's both politically stupid, but even if you had a political basis, you really couldn't do it in any kind of an intelligent and democratic way. It is, I think, politically serious in America to talk about democratizing corporate power by getting public inputs and vetoes over various investment functions. And indeed, if you could say that the old New Deal, or the original New Deal, and all of the liberalisms that flow from it, basically argued that the corporate infrastructure of America was sound, that the best place to make an economic decision about the allocation of resources was the board of directors of a boardroom, and that what government would do would be to manipulate the fiscal and monetary levers so as to allow the corporations the environment in which they can do their essentially Adam Smithian allocation of resources in the best possible way to everybody's interest. That's nonsense. And I think the new deal, the beyond the new deal, the new radical liberalism, I think has to challenge precisely that old liberal assumption that the corporate infrastructure is sound. After the experience of the decisions made by the American auto companies, railroad companies, steel companies, and on and on and on, anybody who thinks that the corporate boardroom is the best place to make socially useful decisions also can believe in the tooth fairy. And I think that the challenge, therefore, has to be at corporate power at that decision-making level.
The new administration has challenged many of the notions that Americans have held about what the government's responsibility is to its citizens. So let me turn that question on you and ask you, what do we have a right, do you think, to expect our government to provide for each of us as citizens?
See, I think, if you will, that question is posed in a way of the of traditional liberalism, if you will. Let me give you a sort of a basic divide in political theory. And that divide is between Immanuel Kant and Karl Marx. And that divide is, do you view society as a group of atomized individuals in which I have a right to do anything that doesn't conflict with your rights, in which we do not have a relationship with one another, that we are basically hostile units or indifferent units, and that my freedom is limited by your freedom and your freedom by my freedom? That's one conception. There you say, what rights do I have? Bill Buckley loves to say, why should somebody in New York have to pay for a welfare mother in Mississippi and et cetera? Why should we pay for anybody in Tanzania or Bangladesh? The other conceptions, not just Marx, I mean, after all, conservatives like Hegel and Edmund Burke have had it also, is a conception that society is an organism of people who relate to one another. And the left-wing notion is that is of cooperation, not so much of rights, but of cooperation. And the terrible thing in this society, if we think only in terms of rights, then in the next period with Reaganomics, we're going to see the black fighting the white, the men fighting the women, the cities fighting one another, the generations fighting one another. Everybody will be looking for their right, their entitlement, and it will be against somebody else. One of the most vicious things Reagan has done is in effect to turn the question of welfare, the Medicaid and education cuts over to the states and the cities. He said, I won't decide here in Washington. I will just give you a block grant and you decide on 20% less money how you're going to run education and medical care in your area. And that's guaranteed to pit the schools against the hospitals, et cetera. And I think that therefore what a socialist or a left-wing notion is what are the rights? I think that there is a basic and fundamental right of every human being not to be programmed by the accidents of their birth. That what is the socialist ideal? That no human individual will have their life determined for them at the time they are conceived. And for most of the human beings on this planet up until this very moment, where you are conceived, by whom you are conceived, tells more about your life than anything that you will ever do. And therefore, I think in that sense, if I can cite a very unpopular phrase, I agree with Condorcet that humanity is infinitely perfectible, never perfect, but infinitely perfectible. I see no limits to the rights we should strive for in cooperation, not in antagonism.
So getting back to my question, I said, what do we have a right to expect from the government and that the government would provide for us? You're saying it's not a question of the government providing for you, but the question should be, how should the society be organized so that we work in cooperation with one another so that everybody has what they need?
And that as long as we think of the government as them, we're going to be wrong. We have to not only think of, but make the government us.
Michael Harrington, I really sincerely wish we had a few hours more to talk. Maybe you'll be back in Philadelphia again sometime. We could talk some more. It's been extremely interesting. Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Michael Harrington, who's the national chair of the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. Their national convention is currently convened in Philadelphia.